Just what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant?
Welcome to Keeping It Real with Frankie D. My guest today is best-selling author, actually best-selling Italian-American author, Gay Talese. Mr. Talese, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. And tell us a little bit about your family's Italian background.
To Paris, because he had some Calabrian uncles who were tailors. He apprenticed there from 1920 till the end of 20. 21, he came to America, first Philadelphia, and he then settled in a town called Ocean City, New Jersey, which is south of Atlantic City. He settled there in 1922. I was born there in 1932. He had met an Italian-American woman in 1928 and married her, met this woman in Brooklyn. So I was raised in the Protestant town on an island founded by Methodist ministers. That's an island called Ocean City, New Jersey. And during my youth, which is to say during World War II, I had a troubled time with my heritage because my father's brothers, those who did not immigrate, were part of the Italian army, fighting the arrival of the Americans and the Canadians and the British troops moving up from North Africa into Italy. So from 1942, 43, 44, when I was 10, 11, and 12, I had an awareness that part of my family was in Mussolini's nation, fascist-led. And no matter what the politics were of my uncles, my father's brothers, because they were really people of the land, they were farmers, more or less, my father being a tradesman, but one of the few people who had a trade other than farming in that area. But I was still wondering almost whose side am I on in this war, because my father was very troubled during these years, and I think it's true of many Italians who came to America in the 1920s, or maybe earlier in the late 1800s, when Italy became fascist, beginning in 1922, and fought with Hitler in World War II. These are the people in America whose names were Sinatra and DiMaggio and Iacocca and many, you know, Scorsese and Francis Coppola's people. We were all from the South. We Italians are not from Milan or Rome or Venice or Florence. We're from the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, which is really from Naples south to the city of Palermo in Sicily, the capital city of Sicily's Palermo. So we were part of a different Italy than the Italy of the Renaissance. And what I'm saying that in World War II, with Italy being fascist under Mussolini, those of us who had forebears who came to become Americans, my father being one of many, maybe 800,000 at that point, we didn't really have affection for Mussolini, but we also knew that our families were in Italy, and we were on the wrong side of the war, we American Italians, we people like me, whose father was came from Italy, or my mother, whose people were from Italy as well.
Were they Calabrese as well?
We were all Calabrians. And actually, we thought more of us ourselves as Calabrians than Italians, because Italians didn't mean anything to us. We were so isolated from the ruling classes of Italy after the alliance of Italy called the Risorgimento in the 1860s. It was really where the people from the north, the governing classes, absorbed the south and in a kind of civil war. And so the Southerners who immigrated to Americans, the people I mentioned, Mario Cuomo's people, Gay Talese's people, Frank Sinatra's people, all these people, Robert De Niro, you name it, all the famous American Italians that you think of today are more likely to be Southerners than any other part of Italy. And so we were isolated from this part of Italy as Southerners and thought ourselves as village people, because most of us were village-oriented. All of Italy, when you get below in the mountains of southern Italy, those people along the mountains, in the mountains, along the side of the mountains, or along the narrow coastline, were very village-oriented, very small, family-centered, not having a sense of government. So we Americans of Italian extraction are derived from people who do not have a sense of government, but have a sense of family. And ironically, the mafia is have its families. Well, that's just a small picture of the large picture. The large picture is we all have a sense that family is the dominant force of our nature, and that is not the government. We are allied to family, to kinfolk, a very village orientation, you see. And that was my background, and it's in too many words, perhaps, but that's the history of my origins.
No, no, but what I wanted to know was, okay, where you're from in New Jersey. Now, growing up, was there a lot of other Italians in that area?
No, that's the reason.
It wasn't at
one
all.
One of the reasons, I guess, I became a writer. One of the reasons, ironically, I did not learn to speak Italian.
Okay.
If I had been born in Boston or Chicago, where you are, or New York, Brooklyn, I'd be among a lot of Italians. It's children of Italian immigrants, such as would be the case with me. But that wasn't true. I was born in white bread America. I was born with people who were Protestant, who were the more of the dominant class in the United States. There were actually no Jews in my town of Ocean City, New Jersey, who lived there. There were a couple of Jewish shopkeepers, but lived closer to Atlantic City, which was a more cosmopolitan town, and much larger than Ocean City. Ocean City, as I mentioned earlier, was Methodist ministers, very, very strict and Victorian, and you couldn't drink and still can't buy liquor in that town.
Is that right?
City.
Wow.
The Italians were very few, and I was among the very few of the very few who had a father who had a business on the main street as a tailor, and my mother had a dress shop. So we were a merchant class in this town of very few workers, because mostly the ruling classes were...
Well, if he had his own business, that was quite an accomplishment in those days.
It was an accomplishment. He wasn't Ralph Lauren, but he had a small tailor shop. My mother had a rather prominent dress shop. Most of our money came from her dress shop, to be honest with you.
Oh, okay.
And I grew up not doing well in school. I was very distracted. I was very much of a mind wanderer. I had a sense of detachment, really. I probably was defensive. But I did have great curiosity about people and places such as where I was born and reared. And I didn't do well in school, I told you. That's important because I couldn't get into college when I came to be 17 and graduated from high school. Not with honors, for sure. But I couldn't get any. And my father, one of his customers who he made suits for, among people he made suits for, was a doctor from Alabama in Ocean City. And the doctor said he could get me into the University of Alabama because he knew people.
Oh,
so I went
that's
to Alabama,
how you went
and that was
to, okay.
That was really like it. I became an immigrant. I went in 1949 when I was 17 years old to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which is the site of the University of Alabama. And I went as a freshman, and I stayed 4 years, and it saved my life in a way because I got away from all of my troubled past, and I went to a place where nobody knew me, and I was like an immigrant. I was like an immigrant from New Jersey to Alabama, like a foreign country.
I can imagine, in 1949 especially.
Yeah.
For sure. Do you think that part of the, you know, everybody feels comfortable with their own, and since you grew up not being surrounded by any other people like yourself, like your family, Italian-Americans, that had to be difficult.
It was both difficult, but it was also my salvation. You see, when you're alone, you are more introspective, and you're curious because you're different from everybody else. And I aspired to be a journalist because that's the one profession that would give me a kind of license, a kind of permission to ask people about themselves. And privately, I'm comparing myself to them as I'm questioning them about themselves, you see.
Right.
And I was a natural journalist, even though at first I didn't think I was a journalist. I was just a curious person. But without being a curious person, you can't become a journalist. So as a high school student, even though I was not a good school student, I was a good person for journalism. And I wrote for the town weekly when I was in high school. And then when I got to college, I wasn't a good student in Alabama either, but I was a very good journalist because I wrote for the college newspaper and also wrote for the town. Birmingham was a big city about 30 miles away. And I wrote about college news for the big metropolitan newspaper. When I left Alabama, graduated in 1953, I came to New York, and I landed a job as a copy boy on the New York Times. Not much of a writing job, for sure, but I at least got my foot in the door. And while my foot was in the door, I got to see top journalists and top editors and learned how big newspapers operate from the inside. And I asked you, on my own time, during my lunch hour, when I wasn't working, the 2 days off a week, I'd write little articles, and then I'd show them to some of the kind people that were editors or reporters, senior reporters. And I got some advice, and once or twice I got little items in the newspaper. Didn't have my name on them, but they got published. And this is how I started. And then a little more, I'd read more, and then finally I got things with my name on it. In 1954, however, I was called into the Army. I had, in those days at universities such as Alabama, you had what was called ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Corps. It meant that you'd have to serve a couple years at some point. And I was called in the Army in 1954, late 54. Spent a couple of years in the Army, went to Germany. And as a result of being in Frankfurt, Germany, I got on furlough, I was able to go to Italy. And that's the first time I was in Europe, and the first time I saw Italy was in 1955. And I went down to Calabria. I got on a train in Naples and went all the way down. And it was like World War II was still there. There wasn't shooting and soldiers, but the remnants of the war, 10 years later. And you could see it. You could see the battlefields. You could see the bunkers. And also you could see how little progress was made in southern Italy at this point in 1955 when I first saw it. It was like you're in the Dark Ages. People didn't have cars. They had mules. And up the hills of these mountainous villages, as I told you, characterized the Calabria.
Right.
Mountainous villages. You see people in mules and women with on their heads was firewood and vegetables. And you look like an ancient picture of biblical times. And I was there with my lieutenant's uniform. I was in the tank corps, and I was like a conquering hero 10 years after the war was over. This is 55, as I said. And my uncles and people that I met who were in the Army in World War II now were farmers again, and they couldn't speak a word of English, and I couldn't speak a word of Italian. And I had very little knowledge of what I was hearing because I couldn't understand, but I did have a lot of knowledge from what I saw. And what I saw was what I came from. I saw, as a son of, 23, 24 years old, I saw what my father had left, and I also saw what drove immigration, which was to escape the poverty and the hopelessness of those parts of Italy that were still in the feudal period, you know?
Right, right.
And this was an eye-opener for me. Many years later, I'd write a book about it called Unto the Suns. I revisit my origins, and I revisit my experiences, my doubts, my self-doubts, my questionings about myself and the people I would be interested in knowing about.
Did your father have relatives in the United States when he came here?
No.
Wow.
No, he had one cousin named Nicholas Pileggi, who, when he got married, Nicholas Pileggi in Brooklyn, my father attended the wedding, and my father fell in love with the sister of the bride. And the sister of that bride, Nicholas Pileggi's wife, is the mother of Nicholas Pileggi,
the author,
writer, who wrote Goodfellas and,
oh my gosh,
and Casino, you know, with Francis Coppola.
Yes,
with,
absolutely. So that's
Scorsese.
That's your cousin.
And Nicholas Pileggi married the great director Nora Ephron. You know her from Sleepless in Seattle.
Yes.
This is the same guy. So this comes right out of my family. Some
wow.
Interesting.
That is very interesting. I did not know that. Wow. Okay. Excellent. Tell me a little bit about, if you don't mind, the Sinatra article in Esquire.
Yeah, when I was published in after I left the New York Times, I said I started as a copy boy, but later on, after the Army, I got a job as a reporter, worked about 9 years at all kinds of stories. And in 1965, I was about 32. I had a one-year-old daughter. I got married in 1959. I got married in Rome to an American girl. We went off and more or less eloped.
Oh, that's excellent.
And then in 1964, my first daughter was born. In 65, I thought, well, you know, I'm 31, 32, and I better get. I want to do more than just write for newspapers. I want to write long pieces. So for 1 year, I took a job with Esquire, which is a very wonderful magazine in those days. It was about the best magazine in the country. Tom Wolfe was working for it. Norman Mailer was working for it. Joan Didion, and Gore Vidal, William F. Buckley Jr., many people, political people, writing, fiction writers, nonfiction writers of all kinds. And I was one of them. And I was given a contract to write 6 pieces a year. Well, one of the pieces that was assigned to me, it wasn't my idea, it was Frank Sinatra. I admired Sinatra from the time of my boyhood in Ocean City, New Jersey. I listened to him on the radio, Lucky Strike Hit Parade, during the 1940s. But when the editor assigned me to Sinatra, I said, you know, he's been done. Everybody knows him. He's so famous. What can you write that has not been written? And he said, well, it's an easy story for you. It's a cover story. You're guaranteed cover on this story. Oh, I said, well, that's interesting. But he said, yeah, go out there. It's all set. Go to California. We'll give you an airplane ticket, put you in a nice hotel. You'll see Frank Sinatra, spend a couple of days with him, come back, write the piece, and you can do what you want to do the next time. You can have your own assignment. That was fair, so I went out there thinking it would be easy, but it wasn't easy. When I got there, a few days after our conversation with the editor, I got to stay in a nice hotel in Beverly Hills, the Beverly Wilshire. On Monday, I call up Mr. Sinatra's publicity director, and his name is James Mahoney, Jim Mahoney. And I said, Mr. Mahoney, I'm here now. When can we see Sinatra? And Mahoney said, oh, he has a cold. He has a cold? Yeah. I said, well, it's a couple of days. We'll see him later. Well, he said, I'm not so sure, Mr. Talese, whether you can see him, because he now has some doubts about you and about the article. I said, I thought it was all set up in New York with Esquire. No, it's not all set up. He said, because they're worried that you're going to deal with a mafia. I said, I'm not dealing with a mafia. Well, we heard that there are some journalists in New York, like Walter Cronkite of CBS, is supposed to be doing an investigation for a program on Sinatra's affiliation with organized crime. I said, Mr. Mahoney, I'm not doing that. I was told to come out here, cover story about Frank and the man and his music. It's about his music, about his place as a singer in society and history. And, well, we'd like to see your article before you finish it. I said, I can't do that. I can't do that. I couldn't do it at the New York Times. I can't do it. Well, then maybe you should go back to New York. I thought, Jesus, I didn't want to be out here in the first place. I thought, well, maybe I will go back there. I called the editor. I said, you know, this is a weird situation. Frank has a cold, and now they wanted me to see the piece because they're worried I'm going to talk about mafia. And he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, listen, I can come home, or I can stay here and I can talk to other people. I would go to a cheaper hotel, and I can talk to a lot of people that knew Sinatra because the town is full of them. Beverly Hills is an entertainment capital, really, and people from the movie business, the music business, dance business, fashion business, everybody's out here. And they all knew Sinatra because he sang in their band, or he dated their daughter, or he had a suit made by this guy or that guy. I can talk to these people. So, you know, that's what I did. I don't want to take all day to tell you this, but I started talking to these minor characters, and I found in my life very easy to talk to so-called minor people, minor characters. Because I grew up as a minor character. I grew up in the town of Ocean City. My father had a store. My mother had a store. I'd see these customers. I could talk to anybody as a kid. I was sophisticated enough with strangers and with people that had next to nothing in common with me. But I could talk to them one-on-one, and I was very comfortable as a conversationalist. Not good as a student, but I was very good as a conversationalist. And so this worked. I was talking to dozens and dozens of people for the next few weeks. At one point, the same publicity guy for Sinatra, Mr. Mahoney, he called me in a hotel. You're still here? Yeah, what are you doing? I understand you're talking to some of Frank's friends. I said, I'm not talking to necessarily Frank's friends. I'm just talking to get some information. How's Frank's cold? Oh, he said, he's a little better. Still not going to talk to him. I said, well, all right. But he said, I'll tell you what I will do is I'll let you come with me. Frank is going to try to have an audition. He's going to try to record some of these songs for his new album, Frank Sinatra, A Man and His Music. And you can't talk to him, but you can stay with me and we can listen to the rehearsal. Nelson Riddle's orchestra is going to be there. A lot of people from Budweiser, which sponsored this big NBC show that was about a month away. Sinatra was the featured figure, of course. So I accompanied this guy, Mahoney, to the studio in Burbank, Warner Studio in Burbank, near Los, part of Los Angeles. And I watched Sinatra, and I just didn't talk to him, but I watched him. And I watched the voice, and I watched the man, and I watched the music, and I watched the scene, the television cameras, and I described that. In the piece, Frank Sinatra has a cold. That is a major scene in the beginning of the piece. And also, another time I saw Sinatra during my stay in Los Angeles, was I saw him in a bar one night. He still had a cold, but he was having drinks in a bar with a couple of women, and place along Beverly Drive, Beverly Hills, called the Daisy, D-A-S-Y. And that's the beginning of the piece. So all I did, I didn't talk to Frank Sinatra, But I watched Frank Sinatra, and I watched and talked to other people who knew him at various times of his career and his personal life. That's the piece. That's the whole piece. It's so not with Sinatra's cooperation.
So you're telling me that the article, Frank Sinatra has a cold in Esquire, that was voted, or Esquire came out and said it was the greatest article they ever had?
Yeah.
You never actually talked with Sinatra?
No, I didn't.
That's amazing. That is very interesting.
Well, but it's not amazing in a way, because when you're talking, so let's think of the greatest superstars of our time. Let's say someone like the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger, for example, or Lady Gaga, or George Clooney. You talk to movie stars or singing stars or rock stars. What can you really ask them? I mean, they've been interviewed so much. That's why I didn't want to do Sinatra to begin with. They have these canned replies because they're so conditioned to having the same stupid questions posed to them by numerous writers and journalists and television interviewers, whatever.
That is very true.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
wow.
In a way, it was good that he had a cold.
Yes, Sinatra. That worked out very well. It sure did. Question for you. Were your parents able to see your success?
Yeah. In fact, I mentioned a book earlier to you called Unto the Suns. It's really a whole book. I wrote a book about the mafia called Honor My Father. I'm known for that. And I wrote a book called Thy Neighbor's Wife, and I'm known for that. But the best book of my life, for which I'm not so well known, is called Unto the Suns. Knopf published it in 1992. It's about the Italian-American history through one family. My grandparents and my uncles and my cousins, they all have a different slant on the same story because they all came from Calabria, which is one of the poorest parts of Italy. It's this mountain area I told you about. And even those who are farmers are really growing stuff out of rock in that part of the world. It's miraculously possible for them to be farmers when they're really surrounded by rocks. You think nothing would grow there, but it does. Anyway, that's my story.
Well, Honor Thy Father, I have a quick story as well. I read that a few years back, and I have this old paperback that's probably like an original. It was my father's book, and I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and my father wrote his name on the outside of the book, just probably doodling, and when I was reading it, it kind of felt good and special that, like, he actually held this book as well. My father's been deceased for quite some time. Yeah. And that he held this book as well and read it. And that just felt really something good for me. So
that's wonderful.
Yes, it was a good feeling. But last thoughts about, you've had a long life of Italian America. Any thoughts on, I don't know, the future of our people?
Well, you know, that's a good final question, Mr. DePiero. It's a fine, good question, because I'm 84 now, and just turned 84.
God bless.
And I'm one of the few, I think, who remember the Italian people speaking broken English. Nobody perfected the language in one generation. If you're not born here, it really is hard to make it sound with the way you speak English as if you're American-born.
Very
My father
true.
Was not American-born. He spoke English well enough, very good, but not without an accent. So everybody knew he was a foreigner. I don't think there are many people today, because of age, people who are 20, they're probably 25 going to college, they're probably the great-grandchildren or the grandchildren of people like me. And they're generations removed from the immigration from Italy to the United States. And they don't have any sense of Italy in World War II because it's so far back. And they don't have any sense of the working class Italians, the people. There's a novella called Christ in Concrete by Pietro de Donato, I think it is. And it's a book about how the Italians struggled. Mario Cuomo's father, Mario Cuomo, the former governor, the late Mario Cuomo, father of the present governor of New York, his own father was a laboring man, worked, you know, almost like a ditch digger. The Italians who came off the boats, with some exceptions, like my father, the tailor, but most of them were the lowest level of laborer, didn't speak hardly any English. Well, these kids that are going to college today, who may even have an Italian name, Italian surname, They probably had a father that married a non-Italian or a grandmother that married Italian, but they don't really know the rock-hard poverty of people of my generation. So what are we, where are we? I mean, I have two daughters. My daughters are 50, 47 years old. They have an Italian name, Talese, my name, Talese, you pronounce it. That's proper in English, but in Italy it's Talese. My daughters have an Italian sense of history. They went to college. They learned about the Renaissance. They learned about great painters and musicians, etc., from Italy. But they didn't learn about the poverty that I saw myself with my own eyes when I was a soldier in World War, in the post-World War period, middle 1950s, I mentioned to you. And so now, what does it mean? What does it mean to be an Italian-American? It means relatively little. In fact, I don't think that the people even call themselves Italian-Americans. They, oh, I had some Italian blood in me. My great uncle came from Calabria, or my mother-in-law's father came from Potenza or from Palermo or someplace. But, you know, the Italians are not a great minority as they were when I was young. We have two Supreme Court justices who are Italian-Americans. We could well someday have an Italian-American president, you know. Maybe if Mario Cuomo had done it, he would have succeeded. I don't know. But the point is, we are not called Dago and WAP, which I was in this when I was a kid. People don't even know what WAP and Dago is, probably.
No, they probably don't.
You know what
anymore.
I mean?
Yes.
So what we've done, in a good way, is we've assimilated. We Italian-Americans have assimilated. Three generations beyond me, they've assimilated to the point, these grandchildren that I don't have, but anyway, people that are Americans of Italian origin who are now in their 20s, maybe 30s, have only a distant sense of Italy. If they go to Italy, where do they go? They go to Rome, they go, they stay at the Excelsior Hotel, they buy a new pair of shoes, and they get a coat that they think is cheaper than they get on Madison Avenue. They go to some Brioni or someplace like that.
Right.
That's
right.
All they know. They don't
no, that's true.
Venture. They don't, hardly any of them venture to the South, go into places, you know, like Campania or Palermo or my place, Calabria. They don't go there.
I was very fortunate to meet a girl that was born in Calabria.
Is that right?
Yes, right outside of Cosenza.
And did you go there?
I've been there many times. I've been there many times, up in the mountain.
What very few of your audience has seen.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, she was actually born in their house with a midwife.
Right?
Up in a mountain in a small, small town. It's one street. And her parents did work the land, and my father-in-law worked construction. And to this day, he is 86 years old, as well as my mother-in-law. And they still, he has about three gardens growing, and this man could grow anything. And they still make wine and make bread and do all
wow.
kinds of things. And I've been very fortunate to have been brought into this family, and it's been a wonderful last 28 years for myself. And
well, I'm delighted to hear that.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you. And you are one of our best and greatest Italian-Americans.
Wow.
We're very proud of you. And if you make it to Chicago one day, please, you got to come to my house, and my wife's
right.
going to make an authentic Calabrese dinner.
All right,
okay?
I have your address and phone number.
Yes,
thank you. Good luck to you, and
Mr.
good luck for your show.
Mr. Gaetano Talese, thank you so much
okay.
for doing the show. Take care.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And as we always do, concluding that great interview with Mr. Gay Talese, I was very happy and lucky that he agreed to do the show. Our quote of the show with some inspirational words. I don't know who said these, but I know who gave it to me, this quote. That was Mr. Marco Rousey, that great Italian-American from Melrose Park. So, be somebody who makes everybody feel like a somebody. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Mr. Gay Talese, and have a great Italian-American day.